Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Stronger Minds with me, Kimberly Wilson. I'm a chartered practitioner, psychologist and author with a master's degree in nutrition. So I talk about psychology, mental health, food and everything in between. The aim is that you leave this short podcast informed and in possession of some helpful, practical tips to support your well-being. Today I want to talk about love languages, both the concept and the hugely popular book. So in the first half of the episode, I'll be focusing on the book, some notes of factual inaccuracy, an anecdote that troubled me, and then in the second half, I'll be looking at the science behind the concept itself. As ever, let's start with a definition. The concept of love languages is derived from a book first published in 1992 called The Five Love Languages: How to Express Heartfelt Commitment to Your Mate, and then a later version, The Five Love Languages: The Secret, the Love That Lasts. It's written by Gary Chapman, a Christian minister and marriage counsellor, and his background is relevant to one of the things that I found most troubling, which I'll get into later. I'll also be using clips from the audiobook The Five Love Languages, which is read by Dr. Chapman. Gary claims that there are five love languages, ways that people recognise and prefer to receive love from their partner. He says that these are words of affirmation, quality time, receiving gifts, acts of service, and physical touch. On top of these five ways of loving, the book makes two other key claims. First, while all are considered important, he says that each person will have a dominant love language. And finally, that relationship troubles can be linked back to people speaking different love languages, which he says are as different from each other as English is from Chinese. When couples are experiencing difficulties, he recommends that they observe one another to try to identify their partner's love language and then act towards them accordingly. In terms of the love languages themselves, case studies of the couples he has worked with make up the evidence for his theory. But in the chapter on discovering your primary love language, he makes the following scientific claim.
For the male, sexual desire is physically based. That is, the desire for sexual intercourse is stimulated by the buildup of sperm cells and seminal fluid in the seminal vesicles. When the seminal vesicles are full, there's a physical push for release. Thus, the male's desire for sexual intercourse has a physical root. For the female, sexual desire is far more influenced by her emotions. If she feels loved and admired and appreciated by her husband, then she has a desire to be physically intimate with him. But without the emotional closeness, she may have little physical desire. Her biological sexual drive is closely tied to her emotional need for love.
This is untrue. Which bit of it is untrue? All of it. All of it is wrong. Firstly, sexual desire is not a unified phenomenon. There is more than one type of sexual desire. For example, spontaneous, you suddenly start feeling sexy. Or responsive, someone is initiating sexual activity and you start to feel aroused in response. Sexual desire is also different when you are solo versus when you are with one or more other individuals. Biologically, male sexual desire is linked to minimum levels of androgens or hormones such as testosterone, though it's a non-linear relationship, which means that more testosterone does not necessarily mean more sex drive, and the other hormones are still under active investigation for their role in male libido. The other major organ responsible for male sex drive? No, it's not his testicles. It's the brain, activity in the prefrontal cortex, the decision maker, connectivity with the amygdala, which is linked to novelty and threat, activation in the medio-orbital frontal cortex, which is linked to emotion and reward. What's going on in the brain is hugely important for the male sex drive. And we see this clearly, for example, in the negative impact that stress and depression can have on sexual and erectile function. So, nothing to do with sperm pressure in the testicles. This misinformation is annoying because this kind of pseudoscientific justification is used to give credence to the idea that a man's sexual appetites are somehow more real, urgent, and therefore less under his direct control than a woman's, or that a man needs sex more than a woman, or for reasons that are more legitimate than hers. And I'm just not having it. And I'm sure Mr. Chapman wasn't being deliberately false, and I'm almost certain that he believes it to be true. But this is why authors have a responsibility to consult the evidence base before publishing their assertions. And as for claims about female sexual desire being emotionally driven, well, not so much. Again, this is a well-worn narrative and, without taking up too much time in this episode, is linked to historical difficulties identifying and accepting female sexuality, whether it's seen from an evolutionary biological perspective or a psychological one. Partly because the signs of female sexual desire are not as overt as a male's, partly because for centuries women were excluded from scientific endeavour. Only recently has women's libido started to be investigated by female scientists, partly because of paternity anxiety, and because of difficulty thinking of women as both maternal and sexual. I should definitely save this for another episode, but the upshot is that female sexuality has been defanged. It's wrapped up in a soft blanket of emotional connection and romance. The idea being promoted is that a woman can only really enjoy sex if she's in love with the person she's having sex with. But female desire isn't particularly emotionally driven. For example, if she's pleasuring herself or engaging in casual sex. In fact, again, sexual desire seems to be more linked to cognitions, that is, women's thoughts and beliefs. For example, women who hold conservative beliefs about sex and sexuality experience less desire. Women who worry about medical problems experience less desire. For women, it is the lack of erotic thoughts like, my partner is really turned on, they really desire me, or the presence of failure thoughts, I'm not getting turned on, this isn't going to work, when will this be over, that reduces desire. That is, it's what's going on in women's minds, not their hearts, that affects sexual desire. That is, Mr. Chapman, I don't want to be admired, I want to be desired. Okay, on that note, it's time to take a short break. When we come back, I'll talk about Anne's story, and then we'll get into the science behind love languages themselves.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome back. The advertisements were automatically generated, so I have no idea what they're for. You'll get a different one depending on where you are in the world. If you would prefer an ad-free listening experience, or you simply enjoy the podcast, you find it personally valuable, maybe you have used my resources in the classroom, please consider becoming a patron. It's a price of a hot chocolate once a month and allows me to sustain the podcast. But if that's not accessible to you, you can always listen to the free feed, which is the one you're listening to right now, which is the same content. If you'd like to find out more, it's patreon.com/Kimberly Wilson, and that's Kimberly with an L-E-Y. The book is punctuated with success stories of couples the author has counselled. And in a chapter titled Loving the Unlovely, we hear the story of Anne.
She had told me the previous week that she had begged him to go for counseling. She had pleaded for him to read a book or listen to a speaker on marriage, but he had refused all her efforts toward growth. According to her, his attitude was, "I don't have any problems. You are the one with the problems." Her feelings of love for him had been killed through the years by his constant criticism and condemnation. After 10 years of marriage, her emotional energy was depleted and her self-esteem almost destroyed.
Anne sounds very vulnerable.
"Has he treated you as an enemy rather than as a friend?" She nodded. "Has he ever cursed you?" I asked. "Many times." "Has he ever mistreated you?" "Often." "And has he told you that he hates you?" "Yes."
She has also sought advice elsewhere.
"Have you talked about your situation with any of your friends?" I asked. "With two of my closest friends," she said, "and a little bit with some other people." "And what was their response?" "Get out," she said. "They all tell me to get out, that he will never change, and that I'm simply prolonging the agony. But I just can't bring myself to do that. Maybe I should, but I just can't believe that's the right thing to do."
Now, Anne, as the story is told to us, is not forced to do anything. She's described as being torn between wanting to leave because of the emotional pain she is in and wanting to stay in the marriage due to her religious beliefs.
"I knew that Anne was a deeply religious person and that she attended church regularly. I surmised that perhaps her only hope for marital survival was in her faith."
It's a very difficult dilemma. We hear that her husband is unwilling to make any effort to improve the marriage, and as such, the burden of responsibility falls on her. This is what she is advised to do.
"I decided to do an experiment. What if you go home and say to Glenn, 'I've been thinking about us, and I've decided that I would like to be a better wife to you. So if you have any suggestions on how I could be a better wife, I want you to know that I'm open to them.' Look for positive things in Glenn's life and give him verbal affirmation about those things. In the meantime, stop all verbal complaints. If you want to complain about something, write it down in your personal notebook rather than saying anything about it to Glenn this month. Begin taking more initiative in physical touch and sexual involvement. Surprise him by being aggressive, not simply responding to his advances. Set a goal to have sexual intercourse at least once a week the first 2 weeks, and twice a week the following 2 weeks."
This is a man he has been told mistreats and verbally abuses her, and the advice is for her to stop complaining and to give him more sex. This is a vulnerable woman. She needs protecting, not to be encouraged to make herself more subservient to her husband. Anne says,
"Oh, Dr. Chapman, this is going to be difficult. I have found it hard to be sexually responsive to him when he ignores me all the time. I have felt used rather than loved in our sexual encounters. He acts as though I'm totally unimportant all the rest of the time and then wants to jump in bed and use my body. I have resented that. And I guess that's why we've not had sex very often in the last few years."
Chapman tells her that her response is normal, but that
If you express an act of love that is designed for the other person's benefit or pleasure, it is simply a choice. You are not claiming that the action grows out of a deep emotional bonding. You are simply choosing to do something for his benefit. I think that must be what Jesus meant.
Really? Is it just me, or does this whole account just feel like religiously justified victim blaming? If Anne can just love Glenn enough and in the right way, then he will be nicer to her. Anne is told that it is her sole responsibility to fix the marriage. But what about Glenn's responsibilities to her? And what about her safety? So how did things go?
In the next 6 months, Anne saw a tremendous change in Glenn's attitude and treatment of her. The first month, he treated the whole thing lightly. But after the second month, he gave her positive feedback about her efforts. In the last 4 months, he responded positively to almost all of her requests, and her feelings for him began to change drastically. Glenn never came for counseling, but he did listen to some of my CDs and discuss them with Anne. He encouraged Anne to continue her counseling, which she did for another 3 months after our experiment. To this day, Glenn swears to his friends that I am a miracle worker.
Glenn was, unsurprisingly, delighted. He didn't have to do anything, and all of a sudden his wife is complimenting him and giving him regular sex. And he responds positively to almost all of her requests. I'm not entirely sure that that's a fair trade. And of course, this is where the author's faith background is relevant. For the faithful, marriage is a sacred union under God, and one must work to uphold that union at almost all costs. This is Anne's, though interestingly not Glenn's, dilemma. Dr. Chapman is a Christian minister and marriage counsellor. My academic and clinical training as a psychologist was secular, but I'm surprised that there hasn't been more critical analysis of the underlying premises of a book that has garnered such broad and popular appeal. Is it true that all or even most problems in a marriage can be traced back to couples speaking different love languages? Can or even should all marriages be saved? Which brings us neatly to the science. We've already seen Mr. Chapman fall foul of the biology of sexual desire. But what about the validity of love languages themselves? Fortunately, a study published this year reviewed the available evidence and answered that question for us. First, they found no consistent evidence for people having one primary love language. Rather, when you give people free choice, they will tell you that different ways of showing appreciation are equally important in different contexts. Sometimes I want my partner to hold me. Sometimes I want them to tell me the dinner I made is delicious. Sometimes I want them to take some chore or responsibility off my shoulders. It's really not about the specific act itself. It's about my sense that my partner is paying attention, notices my needs or emotional state, and cares enough to make some effort to meet those needs or support me. On the claim that there are five love languages, the researchers also note that other work highlights additional ways that couples express and feel love, like, quote, integrating a partner into one's broader social network and developing effective strategies to manage conflict. After that, the other assumptions fall away. If we don't have one primary language, it doesn't make sense that problems arise from partners speaking different languages. The researchers, Emily Impit and colleagues, suggests that the claim that there are five love languages is, quote, oversimplifying relationship processes and categorizing people in rigid or limited ways. For the general audience, strictly adhering to the love language label may lead them to undervalue other expressions of love outside of their primary love language, dismiss the full range of emotional needs and preferences that go beyond the limited scope of five love languages, or discount potential or current partners who do not match their primary love language. End quote. Rather than trying to focus on a single love language, they suggest thinking about a healthy relationship like eating a balanced diet. You can't rely on one thing to do all the heavy lifting. You need a little bit of several things to ensure your relationship is well nourished. So, there's no support for the three central claims of Mr. Chapman's book, but it is hugely popular, so it seems that he must be getting something right. Relationship science tells us that of the dozens of factors and the hundreds of combinations of factors that might lead to long-term relationship happiness, and those are things like how attractive your partner is, how much money they make, how tall they are, their faith, values, beliefs, and so on, only a handful have been shown to have a significant effect or any predictive validity on relationship quality. They are how committed to the relationship you perceive your partner to be, how satisfied you perceive your partner to be, how much appreciation you show your partner, sexual satisfaction, and conflict status, so having low conflict or having good conflict resolution skills. So, to my mind, what this book does is to essentially manualize demonstrations of commitment and appreciation. The book creates an opening and a focal point for couples to initiate important but often difficult conversations about how they feel about each other or what they might need from one another. I think the book helps to translate something that is relatively complex, our worries about rejection and abandonment, and turns them into practical actions. And I think this is valuable, particularly for people who perhaps had not grown up in emotionally demonstrative families or haven't learned the skills of showing the appreciation, kindness, and love they might feel for others. And the labels help to make us feel understood. It makes us feel like we know ourselves a little better. We see this happen with personality tests as well, and I'll tackle those in a future episode. So, there's no evidence to suggest that we all have a primary love language, or even that there are five love languages. Couples with the same love language are no more satisfied in their relationships than couples who speak different love languages. But perceived commitment and satisfaction and demonstrations of appreciation are essential for relationship happiness, and the book shows you how to achieve that. However, it should be considered a starting point and not the end of the story on how to support your partner and your relationship. And it should always be done in the context of a relationship that is safe. What we want in our relationships is to feel that we are being thought about and cared for. So here are some of my favourite simple questions you can start to use to help demonstrate this to your partner. How did you sleep? Have you got a stressful day ahead today? How was your day? Can I help you with that? And a phrase, not a question, I missed you. Okay, that is all I have for you today. If you have any thoughts or comments on this topic, please pop them under the Instagram post for this episode, which I will link in the description. Tell me what you think. Have you found the concept of love languages to be valuable in your own relationship? Late at night when it's dark and quiet, do you find yourself wondering, how is Anne doing? If you enjoyed this episode, please consider either sharing it or leaving a positive review. It helps other people find it. That just leaves me to thank you very much for listening, and until next time, take very good care.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.